folks, and welcome back to another episode of your Brains Coach podcast. My name is Angela Sharina. I'm your host, I'm your Brains Coach, and it is my job here to bring you all the best extracts and insights from different branches of science, of human health, of neuroscience, of human performance, to help you to create your own toolkit, your own set of brain-body tools to help you to feel, look, and do your absolute best consistently expressing your potential in this world. Folks, today I'm super pumped and excited because our guest is someone who I've been dying to talk to for like months. After I finished reading his book, I'm like, I gotta have Rich Devini. This is the guest on today's podcast on your Brains Coach podcast. So Rich Devini, he is a retired Navy SEAL commander who served 20 years in the U.S. Navy. And then Rich has become a consultant and speaker, sharing his experience and insights on leadership and human performance with businesses, sport teams, and individuals. Rich is inspired, just like myself, by human potential and what we can achieve. And Rich is very passionate about helping people to discover and develop their potential to ultimately create a better world for all the humanity. So that's an amazing goal, amazing aspiration, and Rich is delivering on it. Rich is the author of the book that we're going to talk about on this podcast, among other things. So the book, The Attributes, 25 Hidden Drivers of Optimal Performance. And folks, why I absolutely love the book and why I think you gotta check this book out and read it and take action, take assessments. You'll understand what I'm talking about. This book connects this very often intangible field of self-development, very often hard to measure and wrap your head around. So it connects this field of self-development with the science of human biology, with neuroscience, the sciences of peak performance. And this book, through stories, explains very often difficult to grasp concepts. And it gives you a very precise and scalable tools based, again, on the science of human biology, neuroscience, and performance. So the book gives you very practical tools, and a lot of those tools you're going to learn about on this podcast. So this book gives you these very practical tools to start developing your potential in a very practical, measurable, and step-by-step instead of overwhelming way. So without further ado, you know, folks, I could be talking about Rich work for hours and hours, but I think there is nothing better than learning about his work and different tools from hearing from Rich himself. So tune in, learn, and get better at expressing your full potential that we are all looking forward to see. And so Rich, welcome to Your Brains Coach podcast. Thank you so much for coming, joining me as a guest today. Really excited.
Well, thank you, Angela. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Rich, I'll be honest. I'm nervous. I was nervous to even start this conversation because I was like, well, Rich being in, you know, as a Navy SEAL, he worked for 20 years. He's been through so many different situations that I can't even, you know, imagine. Like, what can I possibly ask that doesn't sound stupid? I don't know if you ever get this question, but it's like, how does regular, you know, life seem compared to all the experiences that you had? Does it seem sometimes a little bit, you know, like people might share with you problems and you're like, yeah, that's nothing, you know, compared to what I've been through, you know, what are you nervous about? Like, does it sometimes, you know, seem like that?
Well, so it's an excellent question, actually. And the answer is it can't, I suppose it could if you let it, but I think to approach it that way would be somewhat both judgmental and I think arrogant. I think we, as human beings, always perceive that the environment around us in our own unique personal way, and when we talk about things like fear or excitement or any of these emotions, our emotional response is very subjective. And it's just so just take fear, because I talk about fear a lot, as you know. And fear, while different things can scare us as different human, you know, based on who we are, right? The physiological results of fear are exactly the same thing in every human being, which means that I could be with my SEAL buddies in a gunfight in Afghanistan and could literally be feeling less physiological fear than the 8-year-old who you just asked to stand up in front of the class to give a presentation, you know? So when we talk about the comparisons between Navy SEAL life and regular life, what I always like to do is say, well, let's take the environments out and just start talking about the responses. So, you know, we all approach life experiences with different perceptions, and certain things that scare one person don't scare another person. And I'll be honest with you, there are some people who are really, really tough and gritty out there, and they're not Navy SEALs. There are some people who are way more tough and gritty than Navy SEALs. There are people out there who've been through way more danger and toughness and hardship than any Navy SEAL has. And so that's where I try to approach life. I would say this, so I don't dodge the question fully. I would say that the one thing I did have to get used to is just the way that that most people just view time. For example, when you're in the Navy SEAL teams, in my business, everything, like, you needed something done, it happened like now. I mean, everything was done. I always joke. There's three types of time that's described in the military. There's military time, there's civilian time, and then there's Navy SEAL time. Military time is if you're not 15 minutes early, you're late. Okay, that's what they're saying. Civilian time is anywhere between start time and 15 minutes, you're fine. Navy SEAL time is plus or minus 30 seconds, right? And that's how we used to plan our helicopters. Like, you know, the helicopters would be like, hey, we will be there at 12:32 plus or minus 30 seconds. And so now, getting out of the military, I had to really realize that most people don't think that way, and nor do they have to. So I think that's kind of one of the biggest adjustments I had to make.
Yeah, I guess it sounds right, but I also, you know, like in my mind, I just thought, like, when you're going through life and death situations, like real life and death situations, yeah, that it's a little bit scarier. Like, and after that, you know, just going through some, I don't know, business disaster, right? Doesn't seem that scary.
there is a perspective shift, and I would say that for me, even for my wife, for anybody who's been in that environment, right? We don't get riled up by the same things that other people get riled up by, right? So we don't find drama. We're very low drama people, mm-hmm, because we've seen high drama and we've had to live through high drama. So I think you are right in terms of the way we perceive things. A lot of things just we say to us, well, that's not a big deal, whereas other people might think it's a big deal. But again, I don't want to judge people because they haven't had. I mean, had you put that person who's making a big deal of that little thing, you put them into an environment where they had experiences I did, they probably wouldn't think of it as a big thing anymore. You know, so it's just really an absence of their ability to gain that perspective.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, a little bit more, you know, on a practical side, like, are there any exercises or ways that you recommend that people can develop this tolerance to be less overwhelmed by different, you know, things and triggers in life? And also feel like, not a big deal, you know, I can handle that.
I think there absolutely are. And part of it is just asking some specific questions. So the first part has to be that you have to manage your autonomic response. So obviously we all know when we start to get agitated or stressed or even fearful, our autonomic arousal goes up. And as that autonomic arousal goes up and we start to approach autonomic overload or amygdala hijack, right, our frontal lobe, our conscious, our logically thinking brain starts to take a back seat, starts to go to the back of our, and our limbic brain starts to take over, right? So the first thing to do is for people to understand that they can manage that process. As if they can use tools and techniques to bring their anxiety down, they bring their frontal lobe back online, so they can ask logical questions about their environment. Now, fortunately, some of these drama situations, some of these stress situations aren't dangerous enough to make that frontal lobe go offline completely. So the questions someone can ask are very simple, like, what's the worst that can happen right now? If you ask that question honestly, then you'll most people will find, like, oh my gosh, I'm worried for no reason. You know, you can also say, what's the best that can happen for me? Or you know, there's also something called counterintuitive thinking, right? Counterintuitive thinking, counterfactual thinking. Counterfactual thinking employs a technique where you say, what could be worse about this? You actually start to imagine worse scenarios, and you're like, oh wow, I'm glad it's not that bad, right? I mean, so that could be like, you know, well, you know, I missed my train or I missed my plane. Well, I could be on a plane that crashes. Well, that's not, I'm good. You know, it's not that bad, right? You know, so you begin to inject some perspective in your environment that allows you to see things differently. And I think the last one, one of the default ones I would always recommend is just return to a place of gratitude. If you can effectively ask yourself, what am I grateful for in this moment, and really feel that, you will immediately begin to de-dramatize and de-stress. You will. I mean, it's been biologically proven that it releases a huge amount of neurobiology that's really fantastic for our system. So I think just a simple gratitude practice could also help.
Yeah. You know, sometimes when you travel, like I travel a lot, just in changing locations, a lot of things just don't work like the way you expect them to work. Yeah. And then I just calm down. You know, what is good about a situation? You know, yes. I have a roof on my head, you know, I have food on my table, etc. I'm, you know, in a safe environment, and then it calms me down. And then I ask also, okay, what can I actually control in this situation?
That's right. Yeah. And those are perfect questions for de-traumatizing a situation, bringing your autonomic arousal down.
Yeah. And, you know, that's what I also love about your work and about your book, The Attributes, is that you breach, you know, those very intangible qualities of the mind and with biology, neurobiology, and then you give the solution, you know, bridging those. And that's what I, you know, really loved about your book, that it makes those qualities, not that, you know, somewhere in the ether, but they bring them to the level of like reality. And then you can say, this is how, you know, my brain works or my biology works. And this is what's happening. And these are the tools that are also based in, you know, the same biological principles, and I can use them to adjust my state.
Well, I appreciate that. And I appreciate you saying that. And I think that is something I've always been fascinated with, is how we can take some of these, you know, there's a lot of Navy SEALs out there who've written books, and they're all pretty darn good. But sometimes when it's just stories, it stays in that entertainment realm. And when you can start to extract from those experiences things that other people can relate to, one of the fastest ways you can do that is to relate it to our physiology, because we're all the same physiologically, right? And so if you can say, hey, in this experience, physiologically, this is what's happening, and you can relate that to another experience someone else is having in a different environment and physiologically. So as soon as you start to merge the physiology, the tools that you can use become the same tools. It just different environment, same tools. And I think that's why I always wanted to, you know, trend towards that direction, because it brings everybody. I mean, we're all human, so we all we could all use this stuff.
Yeah. And I also think that's why this actually gonna, like, your book will become more and more popular, because people, I think, a little bit tired of this self-development field that is based on stories and very subjective experience, and therefore it cannot be scaled and applied to at least certain degree to every single case. You know, when you actually, you know, like you did, base it in our biology, then people can take it and can reliably say, okay, this is gonna work.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Some degree better, worse, and it's more reliable, and that's what I think, you know, very unique about your book. And you know, to be honest, like when I read online or I heard someone describing your book, I kind of brushed it off. I didn't even want to read it. And then I heard you on, I believe, yes, Stephen Kotler's podcast. Yeah. And then you went into details. And that's what, like, that is more interesting and deeper than I thought it was. And then
I'm glad you were able to do that. Thank you.
it's just, you know, sometimes it's hard to put in like an abstract everything that the book is. And when you actually hear, you know, the author speaking about the book, it gives you a much better understanding of what the book is. And also, you know, speaking of stories, what I also loved about your book and your blog also, why I love reading your book, is because you always explain every concept through a story. And, you know, when you talk about greed attributes, for example, you don't just, you know, say, or perseverance or adaptability, you explain it through story. And then instead of being this abstract concept that you kind of understand, you're like, now I get it. And now I can see how I can apply it in my life. So I also, you know, I don't know how you develop this storytelling skills, you know, but it makes the whole, you know, reading experience it's more effective, and you just remember it better, and you can see how you can apply it much better.
Well, thank you for that. And that was something that I was taught and told by my friends who are authors. So Stephen Kotler is one of them, Simon Sinek, another, but these Dan Coyle, all these great authors who I really enjoyed their work, and recognized that one of the reasons why I enjoyed their work, and one of the reasons why I felt that their work was so so digestible, was because of the storytelling element. And honestly, as human beings, we're just drawn to stories. I mean, when we engage in storytelling, as human beings, we're immediately focused, and so it focuses in our attention as humans. And then, of course, if you can tell a story, it's quite often that we as human beings can relate to that story. And if you can relate to those stories as well, then you start embodying it, and then you start saying, okay, wait a second. How does that apply to me? And that was really one of my primary goals in writing was I wanted to write a book that was about the reader. I didn't want to write a book that was about Navy SEALs or about neuroscientists or anything like that. I wanted someone to read that book, and as they read it, they said they would think, oh, actually, this is about me. And part of that is to diversify the stories, and then also talk about neuroscience and talk about how this kind of makes you think about yourself. And I think that's really the goal that I've always had, and I enjoy doing based on the stuff I've done in the SEAL teams.
Yeah, and you know, you definitely succeeded with that in your book and also with your blogs. You know, a recent one on compartmentalization.
Yes, compartmentalization. Yeah.
And you explain this attribute through the story of how you and your brother, or your cousin, you every, like, what is it, before winter season, you had to carry this wood
moving the wood with my brother.
And so that made it so relatable, because if you just explain the concept, I would say, I understand it, but I wouldn't really relate it, like how now I can apply it to my life. And they're like, oh, now when I look at my business, I can do the same. Now I have like 10-year vision or 20-year vision, right? But first of all, I don't know how I'm going to get there. You know, it's very hard to track exact progress. But what I can do is I can chunk it down and focus on the next step, on the next stage that I see myself accomplishing, right? And that gives me, you know, this dopamine boost, and that gives me energy and motivation, right? And I can see myself accomplishing that, and I actually feel and perform better, right? And those kind of, you know, those connections I really loved in your blogs and in your books. And that's why, you know, I recommend folks to really dig deeper into the book kind of spend a little bit of time to understand, okay, this is how, you know, how it works through the from biological perspective. And in the story, and this is now I can, you know, apply in my life. So that about, you know, the stories. And I think the last piece, what made me like say to myself, I absolutely have to have Rich on the podcast, is that I'm going to read this quote that was at the end of the book. I'm inspired by human potential. We are a species that in only 10,000 years evolved from cave dwellers to space explorers. Humans have the unique and brilliant gift of being able to imagine something and bring it into existence. We are able to do this because of our greed, our mental acuity, our drive, and leadership and teamwork. Understanding your attributes is one of the keys to unlocking your potential. You now know yours. So this quote really like hit home for me. I feel like this is, if not, you know, everyone's mission in life, like at some level, mm-hmm. then it's definitely, you know, mine. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this also, you know, this book contributes to that. Like it gives people real tools to realize that potential. And as you do, I also believe, you know, we are humans are so unique in that way that we can imagine things and we can develop ourselves, develop that potential that sits in us like in a seed, right? We can design environment and experiences and develop ourselves to find, to realize to some capacity our vision and what, you know, how, what kind of world we want to create. So that, you know, really made me passionate like about your message, your book, your work, etc.
Well, I think thank you for that. And I will say that I think this is one of the things you do as well. And I think we're alike in that capacity in the sense that we are, I mean, I'm just insatiably curious about where we can go as human beings, you know, and mm-hmm. And like what the next 100 years will look like, what the next 500,000 years look like, because we've just been able to do so many things that if you just rewind the clock, even 50 years were unimaginable, mm-hmm. or 100 years were unfathomable. I mean, so the fact that we can walk around with a device in our pocket that can communicate around the world instantly and get and actually access, I mean, almost any bit of information that you want instantly is something that, you know, again, 50 years ago was unimaginable. And that is exciting to me. It really is. And I think that I always joke that, you know, I'm not the person who's going to be able to do that stuff. But if I can help inspire the people who can do it, to do it, to kind of explore their potential, the more we can inspire others to explore mm-hmm. their potential, then it's going to be better for humanity, I think. And I think that's something that that you and I share. So.
Yes, definitely. And there was something that I just wanted to say about the device in your pocket, right? I remember when I was a kid, I was watching Star Trek and there were these guys, you know, in space walking around with those computers that yeah. fit, you know, onto their palm. And they had like libraries, you know, the whole generations of like planets in that. And they could, you know, ask anything and read anything. And I was like, how cool would it be to have that, right? Yeah. Or their supercomputers they had, they could ask anything, you know, and ask for suggestions, ideas, etc. And now with this ChatGPT, we almost have it too.
yeah, we have it. Yeah, that's great.
And yeah, that's, you know, back to like human potential and where we're going to end up, like, it's just unimaginable. And, you know, back to your work though. And yeah, I also, you know, want to believe that I'm contributing to the same mission and still yet to discover how it's going to turn out. But, you know, back to your work, what's really great about attributes, and I kind of want to, you know, get into practicality in a moment. What's really great about your book is you don't just inspire, you give people, again, very practical and more often than not, very science-based tools that are scalable. You know, I like this quote by Stephen Kotler, I think, biology scales personality doesn't, or something like that. Mm. Like in a sense that, yeah, you can talk about personal development on all day long, but if you don't treat it in some science about human biology and how we humans are constructed, so to speak, it's very, you know, hard to scale and to give advice to all of the people to develop certain attributes, right? Because they're just going to be so much different for each person.
Yeah, you're 100%. I mean, our human operating system is run biologically. That's what it is. And so to understand behavior and to affect behavior has to be kind of supported or buttressed by this understanding of biology. And then once you get to those levels, you start understanding how to actually affect that and manipulate it in certain ways. So I think it's a wonderful, wonderful concept.
Yeah. And you know, that manipulation that would, I am so passionate also about like we can actually change ourselves at any moment. Like, you know, take a simple piece of, simple tool like music. You can change your state in a matter of like seconds when you put on certain music. And that's why, you know, for example, movies are so powerful. They use this tool, you know, and they create certain mood in an instant. So anyhow, just, you know, human potential, like it's so malleable and adjustable. And we just see discovering all these tools. And that's really fascinating with the fact. But back to the book, I also want to, you know, bring folks very practical tools based on what you're teaching in the attributes, 25 hidden drivers of optimal performance. You know, first, what is optimal performance? You know, we are talking about high performance and optimal performance. When I was reading through your book, I actually thought that for me, they were kind of equal, but then I understood that a lot of people might look at them differently. So I agree with your, you know, definition more of optimal performance. But yeah, can you explain to folks what is high performance and optimal performance and how people can confuse it sometimes?
Yeah, absolutely. I usually talk about either high or peak performance in terms of how people typically describe the arc. And a lot of people are focused on this idea that they want to be peak performers all the time, like the highest levels of peak performance and peak this, peak that. And there's a lot of folks out there who will purport that they can help people be peak as often as possible. But the problem with peak is that peak is an apex. It's the highest someone can go, and there's only one place you can go from an apex. That's downward. And so peak performance also. Well, the other thing about peak performance is that peak performance often has to be scheduled for or planned for. Right. So in other words, the professional football player plans and schedules his entire week so that he can peak for 3 hours on game day, you know? And we don't get to do that as human beings. We don't get to do that as Navy SEALs. And so when people would tell me, you SEALs are the ultimate peak performers, and I'd say, no, we actually aren't. We're optimal performers. Optimal performance is a little bit different. Optimal performance means that I'm going to do the very best I can in the moment, whatever the best looks like in that moment, okay? So sometimes our best looks like peak. Everything's clicking, it's flow states, everything's awesome, and we're at our top, right? But sometimes our very best in the moment is I am just head down and I'm gutting it out, and it's dirty and it's gritty and it's painful and it's hard. And that is still performing optimally. And so optimal performance can be thought of as kind of this umbrella underneath which all performance levels, you know, actually live. Mm-hmm. All optimal performance says is, hey, wherever you're at, do the best you can. So it allows us to pat ourselves on the back when sometimes it is dirty and it is ugly and it's gritty and it's hard, right? That's still performing optimally. But also it allows us to do what I call proper energy management. In other words, I don't have to be peak when I'm driving to the grocery store, okay? I can manage my energy levels in a way that's appropriate for what I'm doing. And I use the SEALs because a lot of people see this on TV and movies. They think of the Navy SEALs kind of before a mission, all huddling up like an athletic team and hoo-yawing and high-fiving and rah-rahing like some athletic team getting ready to take the field. Well, that never happens, okay? We just don't do that. And in fact, oftentimes we'd be in a helicopter flying into combat and everybody around me would be napping. They'd be asleep. And the reason is because we don't know what's coming. We don't know how long we're going to be out there. We don't know what's going to be required. We're not going to waste an ounce of energy on doing something we don't need to do. And that's performing optimally. We're constantly modulating and managing our energy levels so that we can peak on demand and we can recover on demand. And we're also patting ourselves on the back when, you know, sometimes, hey, we got through that, but it wasn't pretty. And that's okay too, you know?
It reminds me, you know, actually a couple of things. Number one, personal, I used to dance professionally, right? And we would do you know, perform that well and you feel so graceful. And then at home, I'm like sometimes like an elephant in a china shop.
That's right. Yeah. No grace whatsoever. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. I'm like, how is that possible? You know, in one situation, I can be so graceful, like, and in another, it's just not. And it's because I think also, that somehow, you know, when you peak as an, you know, athlete or performer, you somehow also learn this discipline of just relaxing really fast, getting back to like, you know, your lower energy stage so you could recover as fast as possible.
Yeah. Because if you try to be like a dancer, like all the time, it would be impossible. You'd burn out. I mean, that'd be ridiculous. Right. So, plus it would probably look weird.
And also reminds me of, like, you know, entrepreneurship journey. So this, you know, idea of not being, you know, always doing like amazing job. Like, for example, I'm learning a lot of new concepts about online sales and marketing. And I feel like the most unskilled person ever.
Yeah.
Simply because it's like, for me, learning to walk a lot of concepts.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And it's very slow and it's very ugly. But this is, you know, the best what I can deliver because I'm at the beginning. You know, I'm just learning a lot of concepts. And that, you know, the concept of optimal performance, it brings mm-hmm. me back to the idea that this is my, you know, high performance at the moment.
And you're 100%. I mean, and grit overall, to be gritty with all those attributes that involve being gritty, you have to perform optimally. I mean, because when you're moving through challenges and stress and uncertainty, and you're working hard for something, it's just not going to be pretty all the time. It's just impossible mm-hmm. to be. And in fact, I mean, we don't learn anything from that. I mean, we don't learn much from when things go right, you know, but we learn a lot when things go wrong. And so the human journey is really, I always kind of describe it as this sine wave, which is just a mm-hmm. series of ups and downs. And that's how we actually want it to be, because that's the spice of life. You know, sometimes mm-hmm. I ask people, I say, do you like roller coasters? And if they raise their hand, they like roller coasters. I say, well, how many of you that like roller coasters would like to be on a roller coaster that only went up? You know, or only went straight, right? No one. I mean, the fun of roller coasters is the up and down the turns, and that's life as well. And so we have to recognize that life itself is designed mm-hmm. to be up and down in series of, and we can't expect to be peak. It just wouldn't, A, it's not possible. B, it would be no fun.
Yes, exactly. You know, how would you know a peak if it was always peak?
Yeah, that's right. It's like eating sugar every day, all day. It's just after a while, like, well, this is awful, right? Even though it's sugar, you know, so.
Yeah. And, you know, about down moments and learning. I don't know if you mentioned that in the book, but I heard, you know, from Andrew Huberman, someone else, that we are like wired, and you are biologically speaking, to learn from our mistakes. Like there's, yes. you know, adrenaline or something else released. Yeah. Like, can you tell our listeners a little bit more about ourselves? Like, yeah. Why should we embrace mistakes? And
yeah. Well, one of the things that Andrew and I talked about, and man, he's taught me so much about neuroscience. When we make neural networks connect, when we connect neural networks, we learn something. Two neural networks connect, and then they myelinate, which means you know it better and better. Solidifies. Well, one of the fastest ways to make that connection and myelinate it, I mean, super fast, is for three factors to be present. All right. Those three factors are intensity, novelty, and focus. Okay. If you have mm-hmm. intensity, novelty, and focus, you learn much, much faster. Okay. So this is the difference between, for example, being told a stove is hot mm-hmm. versus touching a hot stove. Okay. When you're told the stove is hot, there's no intensity, there's no novelty, there's no focus. When you touch a hot stove, yeah, that is seared into your memory immediately. Okay, and this is also why, for example, you know, the ABC, you know, we learn our ABCs through a song, right? A lot of times, at least in the English language, you know, and so people forget, people remember that forever. Right? I mean, they remember those songs. It's also actually why we remember music lyrics, because there's intensity, novelty, and focus. There's emotional intensity, novelty, and focus, right? So all this to say, this is exactly why we learn faster with our mistakes than we do with our accomplishments. Because when we make a mistake, you know, it feels bad, right? So we immediately have intensity of emotion. We have novelty because it's a mistake we haven't made, obviously. And then there's focus. We're deeply focused on what we just did, right? So we learn faster, and we're wired to learn faster from mistakes than we are successes. This is also part of the reason why we have endured as a species, right? I mean, Darwinianism, right, it implies that the strongest, well, not the strongest, but the smartest, the most adaptable survive. You know, the species, those of our ancestors who didn't learn when they made a mistake, tended to go extinct, you know, because they repeat the bad stuff over and over, or at least twice, and they wouldn't make it through, right? So if we didn't learn that way, we wouldn't effectively have evolved to what we are. So that's some part of the neurology of why mistakes aren't a bad thing. Mm-hmm. They're only a bad thing if we let them be a bad thing by not focusing on the learning part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think That's very important. I'm an entrepreneur, and a lot of listeners of this podcast are also entrepreneurs. And we need to understand that mistakes is one, what we'll learn from the most. And second thing is that's where the opportunity for growth is, right?
Yeah,
whenever we do things easy, we're not really growing. We're just repeating probably the same stuff. But, you know, so speaking of memories, I also just analyzed my own kind of like memories from childhood, and almost, and I'm like, oh my God, I remember mostly like negative experiences. What's wrong with me? But then you think about it, that all makes sense, right?
It does. It does.
So yeah, let's get to the attributes, you know, finally. There are so many of them. I know we're not going to be able to go through, you know, all of them. There are 25. What I loved about, you know, attributes, like the way you structured them, is you first created like sectors or areas like greed, right?
Yeah.
And then you identified different, you know, what you call attributes that comprise this bigger concept. And that allows anyone to work on a specific aspect and then get greedier. And that also probably allows more flexibility. Like, you know, what I also loved about your book is that you say all these attributes, they're like sliding dimmer switches, and one can adjust them, but then also depending on who you want to be or in which situation you find yourself in and where you want to go, like you would use different set and intensity of each attribute, right? It's not like the more of everything is better.
There's a sweet spot there, and actually more of any of them, too much or too little of any of the attributes is a bad thing. And we're actually starting to map this out in some of the work we do with organizations when we say, hey, how does this look when you have too much or too little? But just take any one. Take adaptability. Too much adaptability means you're pretty much a limp noodle, right? You're going wherever the wind blows you, and there's no rigidity to you or anything you believe. So you can't be too adaptable. If you're not adaptable enough, well, then you're just too stubborn, right? And you're not going to move when you need to move. And so you pick any of the attributes. And I would say, I'm wondering if there's any exceptions. I think maybe too much learnability is not bad. I have to think about that. But I have to think about if there are exceptions to those. But I'm pretty sure that 99.9% of them, too much is a bad thing and too little is a bad thing. And then depending on where you are in your life and what niche that you're trying to achieve, that's also too much of something could be bad as well. Like, and I always kind of say we're all automobiles. So as human beings, we can think of ourselves as all automobiles, but we're just different kinds, right? So some of us are Jeeps, some of us are SUVs, some of us are Ferraris, and there's no judgment there because the Jeep can do things the Ferrari can't do, and the Ferrari can do things the Jeep can't do. But it behooves ourselves to look under our hood and figure out what engine we're running with, because we may be a Jeep that's trying to run on a Ferrari track, or a Ferrari that's trying to run a Jeep track. And you start to understand, okay, wait a second, that's why I felt friction, because I'm a Jeep that's trying to run a Ferrari track. Now, if I'm a Jeep that wants to run a Ferrari track, that's fine, you know, but I have to understand that there's gonna be a lot of things, a lot of attributes about my engine that I need to work on to effectively run on a Ferrari track. That's still my choice, and that's okay. But just because you're low on something doesn't mean it's a bad thing. Empathy, I use an example, because like the stand-up comic who has too much empathy is not going to be a very good stand-up comic, right? I mean, how are you supposed to find funny at a funeral if you're too empathetic? So we have to look at these attributes as very neutral. We have to understand where we fall in a very non-judgmental way, and then we have just a very kind of logical way index that alongside what we want to do in life. And if we do that effectively, we will most likely find, especially if we're fairly happy in life, we'll most likely find that there's only one or two that we may need to work on. Now, if we're really miserable in life, that means we're probably on the wrong track, and there might be, and it might not be a matter of working on everything you have to work on. It might be just a matter of finding a different track so that you're happy. But I think that's the beauty of this stuff, is that we can understand our own performance, our own engines, and start to understand how we can better affect ourselves, the world, our goals, and like you and I say, our human potential.
Yeah. And I think, and you know, on your website and in your book, you encourage people to go through the assessment, right? And yeah. figure out like what attributes, you know, they have more of, less of. I think I took the assessment, although I always like, I think my brain is trying to trick me into choosing the right answers.
Yeah.
So I'm always like very skeptical about that. But anyhow, I think it allows anyone to assess like where they are and maybe assess their life and where they're heading and where they might be actually better off. Because in our today's life, you know, we have so many choices. And so if something isn't working out in the place where you are, well, maybe you don't have to be there, right? Maybe you are a better fit for something else. So that's why, you know, I love the assessment, even though, again, I think we human beings are very biased.
Well, we have optimism bias, which is absolutely a thing, you know, but I think the assessment as well, I mean, the assessment is meant to give people a snapshot, really, of where you might fall. But really what's required is once you get those results, is to do some serious introspection. And you say to yourself, okay, well, if I'm coming up lower on adaptability or even high on adaptability, does that make sense when I think about myself in these situations where adaptability is required? So it takes someone to say, okay, well, listen, last time I was in a situation where the environment was changing around me outside of my control, how much did I just go with the flow? How comfortable was it? You know, or was there stress? Was there challenge? Was I really kind of put off, right? Depending on how we honestly answer ourselves starts to speak to our levels of adaptability. So it's less of a, you know, again, I don't think there's very many assessment tools out there that can tell people 100% who they are. I think most of them are designed to be used in a introspective manner and say, okay, now I have a sense. Now let me keep on interrogating myself and introspecting on what I actually am and how I behave. Because at the end of the day, it's only us. We're the only ones who are going to able to really figure out us, right? Because we know ourselves better than anybody else, hopefully, you know?
Yeah.
So the tools are just a guideline to do that.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully one day there's going to be an assessment that will tell us who we are and where we should go.
I don't know. Yeah. It'll be a tough one.
I think in my life, I found that life experiences is that shortcut that actually allows me to learn more about myself. I'm like, okay, I'm in this situation. I behave like that. That means that this is my quality, whether I like it or not.
Well, that's a great distinction, because I think everybody has that opportunity if they do the appropriate introspection on those experiences, because experience is our best tool, 100%. And the more visceral and in top and taste, the more intense, novel and focused that experience is, the more we can learn about ourselves. I think this is the gift that I and my buddies got from going through Navy SEAL training. I mean, being a Navy SEAL and going through that training and then going to combat is one of the purest environments inside of which one can learn about themselves. I mean, we sometimes we know about ourselves. We don't even consciously know about ourselves. We just, you know, I began to put words around these attributes because I was interested in it. We all knew our attributes though. I mean, we just knew it because we'd been through such intense training and such intense experiences. We just didn't know how to put words around it, but we knew who we were and we knew how we behaved. We knew who our most raw was. And I think that's really quite a superpower if we can understand who we are our most raw.
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah. That, you know, Navy SEAL experience gave you that opportunity to be in more like raw situation, right? Where a lot of just bullshit goes out of the window and you just become the most, you know, cleanest version of who you are, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, Rich, I want to go through at least like one set of attributes and a definition and let you maybe give people advice on how they can go about developing those. Specifically maybe in you know, business situations and you know, as an entrepreneur, like how you would go about. Do you have your favorite set of attributes, you know, like maybe I don't know, greed or mental acuity or drive, like what would you say, like maybe where people should start?
Well, let's see. If we're talking about business, I would say we should talk about, especially entrepreneurs, right? Let's talk about the drive ones. I think the drive ones might be the best ones to talk about, because I think that when we talk about drive, every entrepreneur needs drive to do what they're doing. You know, they need grit and mental acuity as well, but drive kind of gets us moving. So drive is really the ability to set and achieve those longer term goals and objectives, i.e. build a business, right? Versus grit, which is the ability to kind of move through those shorter term, more acute challenges and objectives, mm-hmm. right? Drive is speaks to that longer term. So what are those attributes that make up the driven person? Those attributes, there are five of them. Self-efficacy is one, open-mindedness, discipline, cunning, and narcissism. So we'll just roll through them. Self-efficacy being the first one, is a combination of three things. Okay. It's a combination of confidence. I know I can do this. Of, initiative. I have the impetus and the drive to get started. And then optimism. I know that as I move through this, even though I don't have all the answers, I'll figure it out as I go. Okay. Now, the reason why self-efficacy is a combination of those three things, is because two of them, all of them are, even though they're kind of attributes, although initiative might not be an attribute, but certainly confidence and optimism are, they can be inert on their own. In other words, you can be confident, but if you know you can do something, but you have no initiative and no optimism, you're not going to go anywhere. You just sit there knowing you can do it. You know, if you have initiative on its own, then that's kind of just wasted energy. That's like pushing your foot on the gas pedal in your car and closing your eyes and not steering. You have a lot of initiative, but it means nothing. You're just going to go. And then optimism on its own is great, is fun, but it's not necessarily realistic, right? You and I could plant a garden tomorrow and then we could sit there saying there will be no weeds. And sure enough, in several weeks, there's going to be weeds, no matter how optimistic we are. So it's really the combination of the three that create the self-efficacious person. And that's a hugely important attribute for grit. Those who are higher on self-efficacy, entrepreneurs, anybody in your audience who is an entrepreneur has a high degree of self-efficacy because they've had the confidence in knowing they could do it, the initiative to get started, and the realistic optimism to say, hey, listen, things are going to change, but I'll figure it out as I go. So that's the first one. Go ahead. Yes, please.
What maybe like one exercise, two exercise you'd recommend people to perhaps develop that or, make it stronger? Because also, as entrepreneurs, yeah, we have that, I think, to begin with. But then, sometimes you fail a lot of times. Yeah. Do I really have it?
Yeah.
Doubting yourself. Like, are there ways to strengthen it, to develop it?
Yeah, I think the best way to develop your self-efficacy is to force what I call pivots, right? Force situations in your life where you must pivot and you must head a different direction, And I think the more that you have to pivot, that's like you moving to a whole different country. That's a huge pivot right there. And so that is a exercise in self-efficacy right there. So if you can pick and choose forced pivots in your life, you will develop your self-efficacy because you'll have to have confidence, have initiative, and have optimism. So it's a big one.
Yeah, thank you. Pivoting, yeah, great tool. So yeah, the very practical one and simple. Okay, let's move to the next one, and that is discipline, right?
Discipline or open-mindedness. I think it's discipline. Yeah. But all right, so discipline. So discipline. Again, there's two types of discipline. There's inner discipline and outer discipline. Okay. What I talk about in the book is outer discipline. That's the discipline required for the goals that we set for ourselves, that the external world has a say in whether or not we accomplish. So that's like being a Navy SEAL. That's like building a business. It's writing a book. It's becoming a chef. When we decide to do something like that, the external world has a say in whether or not we accomplish that. In other words, as we move through the wickets that we need to accomplish that goal, the external world is going to throw things at us that get in our way, right? And we're going to have to navigate those. We're going to have to be flexible and fluid to navigate those. That's the type of outer discipline one needs. Inner discipline, also known as self-discipline, speaks to those goals and objectives that the external world has no say in whether or not we accomplish. So that'd be like, I decide I'm going to eat healthier, okay, and then I'm in Vegas next week at a buffet. Well, the buffet is not going to throw pastries at me, okay? It's all on me as to whether or not I decide, as to whether I do that. So that's different, okay? And the reason why I've separated those is because these can exist independently of each other. And I've known people. I've known people who are highly self-disciplined, but not outerly disciplined. In other words, everything about their life is structured and routine. They work out every day. They eat the right thing. Everything's like on point, and they're just everything. They can't get a long-term goal accomplished to save their lives, right? They just can't, okay? Versus someone like me who's highly disciplined, outer-wise, and miserable self-discipline, right? It's hard for me. No, no, it's true. It's really hard. I don't like, I always joke, I don't like to be told what to do, especially when I'm the one telling myself what to do, right? I just, self-discipline is something that's hard for me. It always has been, right? Now, I have to implement routine and structure to do that. But it's, again, but if we understand how these things work, we understand our behavior, we understand, we start to get a clue as to why we perform the way we do, okay? So what's required for drive, again, those longer term objectives oftentimes is this outer discipline. If it's something like losing weight, that's more of a self-discipline thing. But even losing weight is not just about eating healthy and not just about working out. It's about changing your lifestyle. And that's going to, the outside world is going to have a say in whether or not you do that, right? So there's elements even in a goal such as losing weight and getting healthy that require outer discipline as much as they do inner discipline. So obviously a good balance is to have a little bit of both.
Yeah. And what would you recommend, you know, for people to develop those? Because a lot of people ask me about, I think, more of a like inner discipline than outer. Maybe if you're an entrepreneur, you know, you kind of have to have outer discipline, otherwise nothing get done. And when it comes to inner discipline, it's like kind of, you know, sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. So what would you recommend for people to develop perhaps inner and outer?
Well, so it's the opposites, right? So to develop self-discipline, inner discipline, you need to implement structure and routine in your life, right? The more structure and routine you can get, the more you will begin to understand and be able to effectively work with self-discipline. To be outerly disciplined, that outer discipline, you have to throw away structure and routine. you have to be comfortable doing things that the outside way. So it takes adaptability, it takes flexibility, right? And so, but again, you're not going to be able to eat the right thing every day. You're not going to be able to, some days you're not going to be able to work out. Some days you're not going to be able to get enough sleep, all right? So to exercise either polarity requires either to implement some structure and routine or to throw it away and be comfortable just letting it loose.
And still getting things done.
And still getting things done. Yeah. So.
Okay. The great exercises. Although, you know, some people might ask me just a little bit more, you know, on inner discipline. Okay, now I have the routine. How do I actually make myself do things? Do you have any tips for that?
Well, it's tough. I mean, again, you know, people have to understand where they sit. So, but you know, it's all about, self-discipline is all about routine. If you can implement some routine and stick to it, you will practice your self-discipline.
Okay, cool. Okay, now, yeah, let's cover the next one. Which one is it?
Open-mindedness, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so open-mindedness. Open-mindedness is actually pretty straightforward. It's really this idea that we can absorb and take into account other perspectives that are outside our own. So this is really like, you know, looking outside the fishbowl, right? We all have our own perspectives. So we all have our own thoughts and beliefs. How easy and how often are we able to get out of that and be open-minded to others? Now, open-mindedness is a passive thing. It's not, you don't have to be proactive. Curiosity, on the other hand, which I don't talk about in the book, but it is an attribute. Curiosity is a proactive thing, right? But it's not, curiosity is not necessarily recommended for drive. It helps, but what's definitely necessary for drive is open-mindedness. You have to have at least a passive ability to say, yes, let me take in that perspective. Let me understand that mine's not the only one and let me be open to other possibilities. So the closed mind, I mean, is just not going to do well when it comes to long-term goals and objectives.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes, you know, to business, right, and being open-minded, what would you recommend, you know, maybe folks to practice to keep their mind open? Because, business environment, especially now, it's very fast-paced, changes very fast. So you kind of like have to keep your mind open to things that, you know, happening outside. Like, what would you recommend to do people? Yeah, maybe practice one or two.
Yeah, I would definitely say listen more. And by listening, it's like really stop talking and start listening to other people. That's a passive way to do it. The proactive way to do that is practice curiosity. You know, be curious. But we go and be curious about other people's perspectives and other people's thoughts and beliefs, right? And start to seek out different things. That's a curious way to practice open-mindedness. But to do that, you have to be curious and not closed-minded, because being curious and closed-minded is dangerous. Because what that looks like is, I know what I believe and I'm going to go find ways to prove what I believe is right. That's being curious without being open-minded. So one of the hardest ways to do it is say, hey, I know what I believe, but now I'm going to go find out what someone else believes that's opposite mine and find out why they're right. right? That is true, like, curious open-mindedness. So it's really, it takes discomfort. It's going to feel uncomfortable. And if you know that any practicing any of these attributes, if it feels uncomfortable, you're doing it right.
Yeah, okay. And then I'm doing a lot of things right. I'm very uncomfortable. but you know, it also reminds me, like, how I practice open-mindedness. If I do something and it doesn't match my expectation, like reality shows me a different picture, I'm like, huh, why is that?
Yeah. You figure
and
it out.
Then I try to accept any answers that, you know, might be possible by trying a lot of other things.
That's good. That's good.
So the next one is cunning, right? That actually was, I think I had different ideas about it.
Yeah, before. Cunning is—it's often thought of as a negative word, but it's not. It's—if you think about cunning, all it is the ability to think outside the box. It's think outside rules and structures. And so I always say the cunning mind asks three questions when approached with a problem or a situation to solve. The cunning mind asks three questions. The first question is: are there rules or boundaries? The second question is: are they real or are they perceived? And the third question is: if they are real, what happens if I break them? Okay, and then the cunning mind begins to seek ways outside the perceived rules. Because a lot of times we approach a problem or a situation and we assume rules and boundaries that exist. And if we actually ask questions like, actually, that's not a real rule. That's not really, I mean, that doesn't exist. Or that's a rule, but if I break it, that's not a big deal, right? I can, or if I bend it, right? So a cunning mind is really just thinking outside the box. Yes, there can be negative or malignant or malevolent cunning. That's, you know, that's Bernie Madoff, but they're going to be benevolent cunning. And that's Oscar Schindler. Right. And so it's really, there's no judgment to the cunning itself. It's just how you use it. That's important.
Yeah. I think actually, you know, for entrepreneurs, it's very important to have this quality, like, especially if you want to create something new in the world and you want to change the world and you want to shape the reality, like you have to actually also a lot of times change things that are not working or, you know, reconsider them. It's like, you know, for me, you know, I've been a digital nomad for 12 years and not even once I purchased a back ticket that they require at the border. The reason is I think this is the stupidest idea. I go somewhere, I don't know where I'm going to be coming back.
That's right.
And so, you know, I figured out my way, like, but that's how my brain always works. So I think I'm high on that attribute, but, you know, to the point, I remember this quote, you know, I think it was about Richard Branson, that he would either end up in prison or become a millionaire. I think I can say the same about me, and I'm not sure which one it turns out to be.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's good.
Any practice that you can, you know, advice.
Yeah, for cunning. Yeah, yeah. The simplest thing is to deliberately ask those questions. So, and when you're approached with a problem or an environment that you need to kind of solve something, immediately ask those questions: are there rules and boundaries? Are they real or are they perceived? And what happens if I break them? That's a way to practice your cunning and start thinking outside the box.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. Great exercises, you know, when people do them, of course. And the last one, the narcissism, also, you know, very controversial one, I think.
Yes.
Most people would probably think about it as a negative thing.
Yeah, and narcissistic personality disorder is a negative thing, right? But there's only about 6% of the population that has narcissistic personality disorder, and that's dangerous and it's very negative. But narcissism at its elemental level is really the desire to stand out and be noticed and be recognized. That's all that is. And I will tell you definitively that every single human being on this planet wants to, at some point in their life, stand out, be noticed, and be recognized. And when we get noticed and this is biological. When we're infants being noticed and adored and recognized by our family, our parents or something, we're getting huge amounts of dopamine, oxytocin, and serotonin. So it's biologically being reinforced. That doesn't change when we're adults. And so the reason why narcissism in a healthy way can be metabolized is it's usually the impetus to some very audacious goals. I mean, why else would you want to start a business? A unique business and make a lot of money. Why else would you want to be a Navy SEAL? Why else would you want to be a great singer, or a great surgeon, or a great teacher? Because you want to do something that very few people can do. You want to stand out, be recognized, and be noticed. There's nothing wrong with that, and it can be the impetus in some very audacious goal. So narcissism metabolized in a healthy way is actually an incredible driver for some of our most audacious goals. And one of the key ways to manage your narcissism, I don't think there's, because I know your next question is, how do we develop our narcissism? I don't think we need to develop.
I want to just the opposite.
The better question is, how do we manage our narcissism? The way we manage our narcissism is we surround ourselves with people who we trust, who love us, who tell us the truth, who don't always put us on a pedestal. You can always tell the malignant narcissist because they always surround themselves with sycophants. People, yes, people who just tell them what they want to hear, put them on pedestals, all that stuff. We don't want to be that. We want to surround ourselves with people who tell us the honest truth, who we're not always on the pedestal. They keep us humble and they keep us, you know, grounded. That's how we manage our narcissism in a healthy way.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. Although in our world, again, that is challenging because either people are afraid to tell you the truth because they care too much, or the world, like social media, will tell you everything bad that they think about
you. Right, yeah, there's a balance there too. But I tell you what, the people who we really trust and love, they'll tell us the bad stuff even when it's hard, because that's one of the reasons why we love and trust them. So.
Yeah. Well, anyhow, Rich, thank you so much. We are out of time. I want to be respectful, you know, to your other commitments. So just thank you so much. This being such a rich conversation, and I think people will learn so much more from it, you know, more about optimal performance and attributes and, you know, how they can develop them, how they can apply them to ultimately create the version of themselves that they want to create to shape the world around them in the way they want, right? The last question, where should people go to learn more about your work and connect with you, like ask questions or interact with you in some way?
Yeah, the best place is just the website is theattributes.com. And there you can find the book, you can find the blogs, you can find links to my social media, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn, and I think Twitter as well. It's kind of a one-stop shop there. If you want to work with us, if you're an organization that wants to do work with us, you can contact us there. So theattributes.com is the best place. Mm-hmm. And I want to thank you. I mean, you and I, it's great to finally meet you in person because we've talked on Instagram and all the social media. So it's fun to actually have a real life conversation. So thanks for having me.
Yes. You know, it's been my pleasure. You know, I also wanted to interact in person because sometimes I can be a little bit overwhelming for people and just the world. But it's good that we finally got to talk. You know, one more thing, you know, if people want to work with you, like, why would they, you know, want to connect with you? Like, what do you usually help people?
Yeah, well, we definitely do. So I definitely do keynotes and talks. That's, you know, if you want to just hear something. But the work we really do that's really powerful is we go into organizations and companies and we help them figure out what their unique attribute list looks like. So in other words, what are the attributes they're looking for in their unique specific organization? And then we help them put those attributes directly into all the different roles. So in other words, you look at every role and what are the attributes you're looking for in each role in the organization. And then mm-hmm. Then we help them say, okay, now we know how to assess and hire for these things. Mm-hmm. What are some ways we can hire for this? What are some ways we can evaluate performance based on attributes, not just skills? And so that's the work we've been doing in organizations. And if people are interested, they can find out more about it on the website or fill out a form and we can have a conversation. So.
Yeah. So sounds great. I highly, you know, recommend people and organizations to connect with you, your work, learn more. And thank you again, Rich. And I'm not going to hold you any longer. Thank you so much for, you know, joining me for the podcast. Really appreciate you and your work.
Thank you, Angela. Great to meet you. We'll stay in touch.
Yeah, we'll stay in touch. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye, Rich.